This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, September 27, 2005. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. Former FEMA Director Michael Brown is questioned on Capitol Hill over Hurricane Katrina response. Voters in Poland veer to the right in general elections. We'll hear from Warsaw. And hundreds of people are on their way to attend the burial for Puerto Rican nationalist Filiberto Ojeda Rios. These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Leanne Caldwell with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Sudanese militias have crossed into the border with Chad and killed at least 36 villagers and stolen livestock. The incident comes as peace talks resume in Nigeria to end the Sudanese crisis. Sam Alakoya reports.
The attack took place on Chadian villages close to the Sudanese border. The Chadian army is reported to have killed 7 of the Sudanese attackers, believed to belong to the Arab militia known as the Janjaweed. The militia, which operates in Sudan's Western Darfur province near the Chadian border, is blamed for the Sudanese crisis, which has displaced more than 2 million people in the last 2.5 years. The mainly Arab Sudanese government is accused of arming and supporting the Janjaweed to attack black Africans who are opposed to the government. On Monday, a senior United Nations official said Sudan's government had done little to disarm the Janjaweed despite its promises to do so. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
Retaliatory attacks and arrests continued in the West Bank, ordered by Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. Meanwhile, Sharon's opponents vow to continue their campaign to unseat him. Menar Jibrin has more.
The Likud Central Committee voted on Monday evening in favor of the Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon against his Likud rival Benjamin Netanyahu by voting against holding early primaries for the Likud. Meanwhile, Israeli Defense Minister Shaul Mufaz warned that Israel will resume its policy of targeting the resistance fighters despite of the latest call by the Palestinian factions for a halt of attacks on Israeli targets. Israeli gunships continued their air strikes against the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip in what is called first-rain military operation for the fourth day, which included the storming of several cities in the West Bank, arresting hundreds of Palestinians, mainly those who claimed to be either Hamas or Islamic Jihad. For Free Speech Radio News from the International Middle East Media Center in Palestine, I am Manar Jibrin.
State officials in Australia cleared the way for controversial new anti-terrorism laws to be passed through federal parliament. Erica Voles reports from Sydney.
At a meeting today in the country's capital, Canberra, the state premiers agreed to allow any constitutional limitations to the proposed laws to be lifted after Prime Minister John Howard conceded to the premier's demands for a review of the laws after 5 years and a sunset clause after 10. Under the proposed laws, terrorism suspects as young as 16 can be jailed for up to 14 days without trial or charge. The proposed laws will also allow travel restrictions to be placed on suspects for up to a year and will enable authorities to electronically tag suspects for the same period. The premiers agreed to the laws following a briefing from intelligence agencies who claimed a terrorist attack could occur in Australia. However, civil libertarians have expressed concern at the lack of details of any safeguards that will be put in place around the new laws. Civil rights campaigners also fear the laws will be used disproportionately against Muslims. This is Erica Voles in Sydney for Free Speech Radio News.
U.S. soldier Lindy England was found guilty for 6 of 7 counts of detainee abuse at the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. Her sentence is expected to be handed down as early as today, where she can receive a maximum of 10 years. She's the last of several plea bargains or trials of low-level soldiers accused of abusing detainees. No ranking officers have been handed criminal charges. Tony Blair and his defense secretary, John Reid, have been lobbying Saudi Arabia on behalf of Britain's biggest arms manufacturer, BAE Systems. It's in order to secure a $70 billion arms deal. Naomi Fowler reports from London.
The British government is trying to sell fighter planes to Saudi Arabia. But according to the British Guardian newspaper, in secret talks, the Saudis are demanding 3 conditions on the sale. Firstly, they want Britain to expel 2 Saudi dissidents. A previous British government already tried, unsuccessfully, to exile one of the dissidents to the Caribbean island of Dominica under pressure from BAE Systems. Secondly, the Saudis want British Airways to resume flights to Riyadh, currently cancelled because of terrorism fears. And thirdly, they want a corruption investigation implicating the Saudi ruling family and BAE to be dropped. A Saudi prince is at the centre of a bribery investigation by the British Serious Fraud Office. The Serious Fraud Office is also investigating allegations that BAE Systems paid the Chilean dictator Pinochet money in exchange for securing arms deals. Meanwhile, many campaigners and politicians are concerned at the apparent partiality of the British government to BAE. So far, the British government has made no comment on the issue. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
And I'm Leanne Caldwell at WPFW in Washington, D.C.
The House Bipartisan Select Committee to investigate the preparation for and response to Hurricane Katrina met for the second time on Capitol Hill today. The 11-member committee heard testimony from former director of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, Michael Brown. The committee has been largely boycotted by Democrats who say that they want an independent commission to investigate Hurricane Katrina response. Washington correspondent Selena Masuta was at the hearing, where Brown spent hours answering questions on what he thinks went wrong.
FEMA doesn't evacuate communities. FEMA does not do law enforcement. FEMA does not do communications.
Michael Brown, former head of FEMA, told House Select Committee representatives that FEMA's role is that of a coordinator, not a first responder. Brown, who was removed on September the 9th by Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff from his on-site role overseeing the disaster response, said that one of his biggest regrets was not being able to persuade Louisiana Governor Kathleen Blanco and New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin to get over their differences so that they can work together on Katrina response. That answer angered many House representatives at the hearing, including New Orleans Democratic Representative William Jefferson, who was not officially on the committee but came to hear Brown's testimony.
I think that's a very weak explanation of what happened and a very incomplete explanation of what happened.
And Mr. Jefferson, I know that you saw what I saw when I was there on Sunday and Sunday evening and Monday, which was no one in charge. I couldn't find out who was driving the resource requirements, who was making the decisions about what needed to be done.
Brown spent much of his testimony rejecting accusations from the media and politicians that he was too inexperienced for his former job. As Republican Representative Harold Rogers of Kentucky went through the FEMA response timeline, Brown told Rogers that Governor Blanco's reluctance to order a mandatory evacuation of New Orleans before the storm was the tipping point toward greater disaster. During his time for questioning, Democratic Representative Gene Taylor of Mississippi disagreed. Brown told Taylor, who gave Brown an F-minus on his job performance, that the government's job is not to feed and give water to people directly after a disaster, that people should know they will be alone to fend for themselves for 2 or 3 days.
So I guess what you are telling me is that in the face of an unprecedented storm, that it was indeed part of FEMA's plan that the cities of Bay St. Louis, Wayland, Hancock County, many other communities are expected to loot the local grocery store because help is quote unquote on the way.
No,
and
my
when you, if I may, sir.
Sure.
And then when you asked, since I was there and I don't recall seeing you there, when you say, what does that mean? Well, it's in the pipeline. Okay, how long is the pipeline? So that means to get here tomorrow? Is it get here Thursday? Is it get here Friday?
Brown admitted that FEMA has a logistics problem. When going over FEMA's timeline, Republican Representative Chris Shea of Connecticut pointed out that in July 2004, FEMA participated in the 8-day Hurricane Pam simulation in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. In this simulation, a disaster plan was sent to FEMA and Louisiana state officials with recommendations for preparations for a Category 3 or greater hurricane. Recommendations included funding for a better communication system, which was denied by the Department of Homeland Security, as well as dictate that evacuation preparations be made 3 days before a storm hits land. Representative Shea questioned Brown on that matter.
You were very clear that your job is to coordinate. I want to know how you coordinated the evacuation.
By urging the governor and the mayor to order the mandatory evacuation.
And that's coordinating?
What would you like for me to do, Congressman?
Well, and that's why I'm happy you left. Because that kind of, you know, look in the lights like a deer tells me that you weren't capable to do the job. I would have liked you to do a lot of things.
I take great umbrage to that comment, Congressman.
Why?
Brown's September the 12th resignation will take effect in 2 weeks if Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi continues her boycott of the House Select Committee by not appointing 9 Democratic members to the committee. House Speaker Dennis Hastert will make those appointments. Selena Masuta, FSRN in Washington, D.C.
As we reported yesterday in the headlines, Puerto Rican nationalist Filiberto Ojeda Rios was killed on Friday by the FBI at his home in Hormigueros, Puerto Rico. Ojeda was born in 1933. By 1967, he founded the Armed Revolutionary Independence Movement, which was later disbanded by police. They regrouped and eventually became the Ejército Popular Boricua, Los Macheteros, whose members believed the only way Puerto Rico would be free from the U.S. rule it had endured since 1898 was through fighting. By 1981, Los Macheteros attacked a U.S. National Guard base on their land, killed 2 Marines, and destroyed 9 combat aircraft. Ojeda was wanted by the FBI for a 1983 armored truck robbery in Connecticut and for skipping bond in 1990. An autopsy now reveals that Ojeda did not die immediately, as the FBI waited nearly 24 hours to enter the house where he lay wounded. Puerto Rican nationalists are calling his death a targeted assassination. We're joined on the line by Zulma Oliveras from the Committee to Free Political Prisoners. She's in Rio Blanco. Zulma, you attended the funeral of Filiberto Ojeda Rios last night. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, I attended yesterday the viewing, and I was actually on the premises where the police and the FBI surrounded the house also on Friday. We were not allowed to go in because the police was ordered by the FBI to stop the people from wandering around while they were doing the operation. The only thing that we could hear on Friday was the round of shots from helicopters. No media was allowed on Friday until the next day. And then thousands of people just gathered at the Lawyers Guild in San Juan, Puerto Rico, to do the honor and salute our Comandante Filiberto Ojeda Rios.
And you're now on your way to the burial. Can you give us an idea of how many people are on their way there?
Yes, we were following the caravan this morning, but between traffic and just the number of cars, we decided to come here straight to the cemetery so that we can greet the whole group of cars that are about to arrive. There's hundreds of people here. It's in the eastern side of the island. Most of the people are wearing Che Guevara t-shirts, Filiberto Ojeda Rios t-shirts. The cars have been graffiti about saying, you know, Filiberto vive. The one thing that I really enjoy the most is the blend of new generations here with the older generations. A lot of students, a lot of graffiti throughout the whole city, you know, saying the FBI asesinos and Filiberto vive. This morning, the governor didn't want to call a national day of mourning for Filiberto because his political views are for the colonial status. And what the students did was that they went to the Capitol in San Juan, took away the American flag and put the nationalist flag and the Puerto Rican flag halfway from the polls as a way of protest and as a way of claiming a very historical moment here and a very tragic day, but also that we honor all the work that Filiberto has done for our patria.
We've been speaking with Zulma Oliveras from the Committee to Free Political Prisoners. She's in Rio Blanco in the town of Nahuabos, where the burial will take place today for Puerto Rican nationalist Filiberto Ojeda Rios. U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice visited Haiti today in a show of support for the interim government with less than 2 months before presidential elections. Rice's visit was the first by U.S. Secretary of State since Colin Powell made a similar one-day trip in December of last year. While Powell was at the palace, gunfire erupted outside, and a police crackdown at a nearby penitentiary left at least 10 prisoners dead and dozens wounded. As FSRN's Reed Lindsay reports, today downtown Port-au-Prince was quiet.
Condoleezza Rice arrived this morning in Port-au-Prince, where she met with Interim Prime Minister Gerard Latortue and other Haitian officials. After their meeting, Rice answered reporters' questions at a news conference, speaking mainly on upcoming presidential elections slated for November 20th.
The message from the Bush administration and also from the international community, with which we have been working very closely, is that this is a chance for a new day for the people of Haiti. These elections must be free and fair and inclusive. The international community stands ready to help in the preparation of the elections, the conduct of the elections, in trying to provide security along with the reformed National Police of Haiti.
More than 2 million people have registered for the elections, but there's little enthusiasm among the majority poor population, and many Haitians say they have registered only to receive an identity card. Frank Charles is a 45-year-old unemployed tile layer who registered for elections in July. He says he will vote, but he's not inspired by any of the 32 candidates running for the presidency.
Maybe one of the candidates will do something good, but judging by the president we've had before, I don't believe in any of them.
With more than $270 million in aid in 2 years, the United States has helped sustain the interim government since Aristide was forced from power amid an armed revolt in February 2004. The U.S. government has bolstered Haiti's often brutal police force with weapons, trucks, and equipment, and is helping finance the elections. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Reed Lindsay from Port-au-Prince, Haiti.
For archives of this or other newscasts or documentaries, visit our website, www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. The global increase in oil prices has led to soaring electricity bills for consumers in many countries. Asia is particularly hard hit by this dependency on fossil fuel, with rising pollution levels as well as widespread hardship on account of surging electricity costs. Yet in the Philippines, an alternative renewable energy source could be offering a solution. Rupert Cook reports on the first commercial wind farm in Southeast Asia.
A Sunday morning market in the province of Ilocos Norte in the northern Philippines. Locals from the town of Bangi browse for fish and vegetables in this predominantly rural region. Despite the plenitude of produce, all the people here have in recent months been hard hit by rising energy prices. The surge in the global price of fuel has raised the cost of transport, which in turn translates into more expensive food. And everybody has seen the cost of electricity increase dramatically over the last year.
Starting last summer, 2005, the electricity gets higher, it doubles. So it's really very hard for us.
For local entrepreneurs like Mayan Santos, that vertiginous rise in the price of electricity can have a devastating impact. Electricity generation in the Philippines is currently especially dependent on imported coal, which is a highly polluting fossil fuel. Yet the country is well placed to take advantage of its potential wealth in renewable energy. As an archipelago of islands, frequently buffeted by heavy winds, wind power is an obvious solution. And in fact, earlier this summer, the province of Ilocos Norte saw the first commercial wind farm in the Philippines and in Southeast Asia go into operation.
Well, I'm now coming inside the tower. In front of me, there's a massive encased transformer. And there are these tubes, like great big exhausts made from steel. And I'm now wearing a harness. I've got some special white gloves with which I'm going to climb this ladder up the tower. Well, I've finally reached the top of this wind turbine. Just turning around, I can see the actual blades of the turbine. They are truly enormous. These blades are over 80 meters in length, and they're more than the wingspan of the latest double-decker Airbus jumbo jet. There's absolutely no noise from these wind turbines, and really, they actually complement the natural scene in front of me. They're like avant-garde art on the beach. Besides being a source of clean energy, wind power in the Philippines can also be highly cost-effective.
In the coming months, the residents of Ilocos Norte should see the price of their electricity averaging 17% less than the national rate. And there have been other benefits. The wind farm status as the first in Southeast Asia is attracting an influx of tourists, pumping much-needed cash into the local economy. Felicie Velasco is captain of the local barangay, or municipality.
The wind farm is a very effective source of energy. We are attracting more tourists, foreign and local. We have plans of training our constituents so that those products they could produce would be sold to those visitors as souvenirs, maybe.
Besides providing tangible benefits for the local community, the wind farm also looks like a profitable commercial venture, as well as serving the Philippines with clean energy. Niels Jacobson is president and CEO of Northwind Power Development Corporation, which owns the wind farm.
I feel we all have an obligation. I want to be able to see my children or my children's children and say, I tried to do something about it. So when I kicked it off, it was of course with the intention to make a business, but also to be able to say, well, I took also my part, and it's a good business venture at the same time.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rupert Cook in Ilocos Norte, the Philippines.
An Amnesty International report says that children in Indian-administered Jammu and Kashmir are at risk of having their human rights violated from both state agents and through abuses from armed groups. Amnesty International urged both the state government and armed groups to respect the rights of children. As Shahnawaz Khan reports from Srinagar, the 16-year-old armed conflict in the region has taken its toll on children in various forms.
Three teenagers were killed by the Indian Army in a village in North Kashmir while attending a marriage ceremony. The Indian Army spokesman said the military regretted the incident and that the army mistook them for militants. This is just one of the incidents where children have been the victims of violence in Indian-administered Kashmir. Children have always been exposed to dangerous situations in Kashmir. Even going to school can be unsafe. Arif studies in one of the prominent schools in Srinagar. In May this year, a grenade exploded outside the main gate of his school, injuring around 20 pupils, a few seriously.
It well left a mark on my mind. It's an unforgettable day because many of the students injured were my very close friends. And I know life for them will not be the same what it was before.
For Arib's mother, Naseema, the danger is daily trauma. Naseema says she remains on tenterhooks every day till her children get back from school. She says as her children grow older, so does her concern for them.
Yeah, dusri baat ye hai ki bachche chote hote hain, to ek maa ko khushi hoti hai ki mera beta.
Every mother likes to see her children grow, but here it's a different tale. As the children grow in height and physique, it brings many more worries, like of them being detained or harassed. Mothers here prefer to see their kids look like kids forever.
Apart from the children killed or injured, there are children whose parents or kin died in the conflict. Ishfaq moved into an orphanage in Srinagar after his father, a militant, was killed in
1998.
After my father died, my mother heard about this orphanage. I've been living here for 6 years now. At my home, I had no idea of my future. Here, I am studying, and I look towards a good future.
Before the outbreak of armed insurgency in 1989, orphanages were an alien thing to Kashmir. Today, there are around a dozen orphanages and social organizations catering to orphans and widows created by the conflict. Nighat Shafi is the chairperson of HELP, an NGO that runs an orphanage with 25 kids and also provides assistance to around 200 orphans living with their relatives. Nighat says Kashmiri social organizations only reached 2 or 3% of orphaned children.
Every day we have casualties of 20 people or 15 people. Out of 20 or 15, at least 10 are with families. If a man dies, he leaves behind at least 4 or 5 kids. We don't have a we don't have small families. We have huge families. So every day you see the number is multiplying. So what I think is nearly 80,000 orphans we have in the valley. And we are catering to a very, very small number.
Witnessing violence all around also leaves a deep impact on children in Kashmir. The Amnesty International said that children in Kashmir are deeply affected by witnessing abuses inflicted on their elders by law enforcement personnel or armed groups. An unprecedented increase in the psychiatric problems among the children and the adults as well has been witnessed in Kashmir during these years. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Shahnawaz Khan from Srinagar, Kashmir.
People rallied across the nation on Saturday in their own communities to call for an end to the war in Iraq. In San Diego, about 2,000 people came together and called for U.S. troops to be brought home now. San Diego is a Navy town with about a fifth of the entire U.S. Navy and Marine Corps stationed there. Miles Ashdown reports.
Marching through the streets of San Diego, former Air Force Captain Rick LeBlanc waves a sign with the body count of U.S. troops lost in Iraq. After serving 7 years in Vietnam flying aircraft, he now volunteers at a local Marine Corps hospital.
What's going on is not lost on these young amputees and these 18, 19, 20, 22-year-olds. They understand what's going on. They realize that Bush was a skater when he went in the Air Force, that he's lied to them. I mean, your commander-in-chief is lying to you. That takes a lot of the steam out of the forward motion, and morale just goes in the tank.
One, two, three, four! We don't want your stinking war!
San Diego County is home to one of the largest military complexes in the world, and about one-fourth of all jobs in the area are due to the military. Eating a sandwich at a deli on the march route, San Diegan Jane Havda voiced her opposition to the march.
I think it's very un-American and very ungrateful. We're living on borrowed time in America, and we need to protect ourselves. I have never been a peace and freedom advocate.
According to Havda, the protest is hurting the country and will result in another 9/11. Local American History College professor George Gastill disagrees. He's seen many of his students go off to fight in the Iraq War.
Because you can love the Navy and it is part of San Diego, but we don't want our people dying for no particular reason, thousands of miles away for a war that really didn't have any basis. It was all based on lies.
Those lies, he says, are sucking money away from education, healthcare, and other important issues here in San Diego.
It's really a question of priorities. Do we want to put our priorities into trying to transform another country against their will, or our own things here at home?
The cost of the war may also mean less medical benefits for returning troops. State Assemblymember Lori Saldana.
Those are the types of financial cuts I'm really concerned about. The ones that when the men and women return from service, they have injuries, they need rehabilitation. I'm very concerned those services will not be there for them.
They really supported the troops, then bring them home now!
In San Diego, for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Miles Ashdown.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica stations WPFW in Washington, KPFA in Berkeley, and KPFK in Los Angeles. Our newscast is produced by Simba Russo and Monica Lopez. Headlines editor is Leanne Caldwell. Today's Washington editor is Selena Masuta. Our technical production team includes Jade Paget-Seekins and Eric Klein. In Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.